You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
There, Blogging Heads audience, this is Glenn Lowry of Brown University and BloggingHeads.tv, the Glenn Show at BloggingHeads.tv. And I'm here with Mark Lilla, who is professor of the humanities at Columbia University and author of the new book published by HarperCollins called The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics. So thanks very much, Mark, for joining me in conversation here at the Glenn Show.
Yeah, good to be here, Glenn.
Excellent. Okay, so your book has created a firestorm of reaction. I assume there's been some positive reactions to your book. I am more aware of the negative reactions. I saw the review in the New York Times book review by the Yale University historian. I'm sorry, her name escapes me now. I'm sure there have been many other reviews.
Beverly Cage. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Beverly Cage, indeed. And you've stirred up a hornet's nest here with your, I want you to talk about your book, but here let me just introduce this conversation with your characterization of a kind of betrayal of the true liberal sensibility of solidarity and togetherness that would be the foundation for building a progressive political culture, and a kind of capitulation to the imperatives of identity politics. Again, I want you to sketch your argument, but I just want you to know that a sentence that I will go to my grave mumbling under my breath: identity is Reaganism for lefties. And to me, that kind of, you know, the self, the kind of worship of the self in preference to the building of bridges to others and the creation of community and of a sense of shared political fate, as I understand you, taking the place of a kind of libertarian, every tub on its bottom, kind of government's not the answer, let me keep my money, I made it, I earned it, I built this, Reagan-esque attitude. Reaganism for lefties. Now, you know, if I were an identity lefty, I would take that personally, Mark.
Yeah. Well, I want to push them. I want to push them. But of course, I put that into the mouth of a Marxist. So, of course, I give myself some deniability there, saying that it's what a Marxist might say. But actually, there's some Marxists who've said this. You know, there's a guy named Walter Ben Michaels who...
Oh, yeah.
Is out in Illinois, who wrote a book about this, very good.
The trouble with diversity, is that the book you refer to?
I remember the title.
Okay.
There's also Adolf Reed.
Adolf Reed. Yeah, I know his essays.
Yeah. And you know, they have a very strong case to make. But you use the word, introducing me, capitulation, and it's not quite the word I would use. I think it's actually a kind of weird conservatism that, there was a time in American history, American recent political history, where all the real action, where things actually got done, was through social movements. That, the Democratic Party was not responding about Vietnam, about civil rights, about gay rights, women's rights, and so on. And so the idea got planted that the only way anything changes is to go outside the party structure and make a lot of noise and get people to move. And there was a time in our history, you know, a few decades, where, in fact, that's where things did happen. But ever since 1980, it's clear that the social changes in our country have the most significant political ones, as opposed to not social changes. Those have also happened with movement politics, but the political changes have happened through electoral politics, which the Republicans have dominated, and now they're chipping away at all the gains that movements have made. But what happened is that the movement mentality from the 60s and 70s got preserved as if in amber in our universities. And ever since, that conception of politics has been handed down to generations of students and eventually more professors and so on. And so people get socialized in the university into a view of what political action is and effective political action is, which is no longer in touch with the reality we have. You know, as you know, Republicans control two-thirds of the state legislatures in this country, two-thirds of the governorships. They control 24 states outright. Democrats only control seven. If the Republicans gain one or two more state legislatures, they could call a constitutional convention.
I know.
And what's going on in these states? The voting rights of African Americans are being chipped away by gerrymandering and by changing the voting hours. There are places where women can't get an abortion, where cities that pass progressive gay rights legislation have it overturned at the state level. That's what's happening out there, right? And it's happening through institutional politics. So what's been difficult to persuade people of, I'm learning, it's not the identity point so much. It actually turns out to be the movement politics notion, the idea that that institutional politics will always trump movement politics. You can always undo something. And getting people, especially in the university world, to see that and to think that, understand that an entirely new approach is needed turns out to be very difficult. They're holding on to these old ways the way any sort of geriatric class would.
Well, hold on. Let me question you a little bit about this opposition you've drawn between movement politics and electoral politics. And I just wonder if the distinction is as clean and clear-cut as you imply. For instance, take the electoral political phenomenon of so-called voter disenfranchisement. I'm asking people to present a driver's license before they're allowed to cast their ballot, and that disproportionately adversely affects minority communities, and so it has an electoral implication.
Right.
Now, if you're in control of the state legislature and the governor's office, you can pass that law at the state level and implement that policy. But if I were thinking how to best respond to that in a state like North Carolina or Texas, I might reckon that, okay, they say people need a driver's license in order to register to vote. I'm prepared to put 5,000 activists on the road, door to door, taking people to the registry of motor vehicles or the county seat or whatever it is, and getting them their IDs so that they can overcome this electoral roadblock. In other words, a movement raising the consciousness of minority voters. They're trying to take your ballot away. This is the new literacy test. But we can beat it. Okay, we can get our act together and we can beat it. Come on, let's, you know, it's who's the Bob Moses of the 21st century kind of idea, referring to Robert Moses from the civil rights voting registration efforts in the South during the 1960s. That would be a movement mobilization aimed at countering an electoral imposition. So that's one point. What and another point is, why do I have to choose between a movement, Black Lives Matter, for example? I'm asking. I'm not saying definitively that you're wrong about this. I really want to just hear what you have to say. Why do I have to choose between people marching in the streets of St. Louis protesting what they believe to be an unjust verdict in a criminal prosecution of a police officer? So that's a movement on the one hand, and people registering and voting the local sheriff or county executive or our mayor or governor out of office on the other. Can't I do both and?
Well, there are two things. Let's start with your first remark. The example that you give is a good example of how movements, one important thing that movements do is that they mobilize people around an issue, around a passion, around something they share. The question is, once you've mobilized people, what do you do? And the example you give is an example of a movement mobilizing people in order to capture institutional power by voting.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense to me, right? But, and this is in response also to your second remark, that movement politics comes with a mentality. It's a way of looking at the world. It's a way of looking at the world that treats power as if it's this external thing, that it's in, you know, there's a castle and the people are outside banging at the door of the castle trying to get something, and they have to bang long enough for something to be tossed over the wall of the castle. But that's not the way democratic politics works. Democratic, our institutionals are movable. It's possible to change things through our institutions. It's possible also to stop changing things through our institutions. So movements that gather together in order to get people, which is what the social movements did more in the 60s and very early 70s, right? The idea was to get them active in the Democratic Party. I'm all for that. But now the idea is that our movements are more and more atomized because we define ourselves in ever smaller groups. What most concerns us is being ideologically pure and keeping our aprons clean. We end up falling in love with noble defeats, and we see the real enemy as being the person just next to us who's insufficiently woke. And that kind of mentality affects all movements. I mean, it affected the communist movement, socialist movements in the 19th century, you know? And so I'm all for social movements that try to, you know, put things on the agenda, political agenda, and get people to vote. The problem is that if you have states where the Republicans and an increasingly radicalized Republican Party controls the institutions, who are you demonstrating against? They don't give a damn. It's movement politics can move things when you're actually pushing people like Democrats to be more radical in their positions. That makes sense. But if you're demonstrating in a state where Republicans control everything, they're going to ignore you. So you've got to focus and give a primacy to institutional politics at this moment. That's where it's at.
All right. I can hear the protests now from the usual suspects. I mean that with respect, although it may not sound so. I can hear the protests. You're saying that we gay and lesbian and transgendered persons, we women who are concerned about abortion rights, we African Americans who want the cops to just stop killing us. You're saying we need to somehow split the difference with the marginal guy or woman who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012. That we need to water down our claims for justice on behalf of some kind of compromise, that we need to join into what is really at its base an identitarian movement on the other side of the scale here. We want rights for women. We want rights for sexual liberation. We want rights for the disabled and for African Americans. And there are other people out there who also want stuff, and they want that stuff in terms of their, what did Ta-Nehisi Coates say in this recent essay at The Atlantic about Donald Trump being the first white president? They want that stuff in part as an expression of the prerogatives that they associate with their whiteness. Yours is really, at the end of the day, you detract from movement-oriented, identitarian politics. Yours is really, whether you mean it so or not, a kind of identitarian politics too. And the group that is the beneficiary of this identitarian politics in disguise are working class, ex-urban and rural white Americans who resent the fruit that these progressive movements for social change have borne over the decades. So there's something reactionary about your argument. How did Beverly Cage put it? She says it's trolling disguised as erudition. Your argument on behalf of anti-identitarianism.
Yeah, and one of my, after I wrote the original New York Times piece, one of my colleagues I've never met at Columbia, who's in the law school, wrote an article in the Los Angeles Book Review comparing me to David Duke.
Well, there you are. I didn't mean it quite that sharply, but that's the spirit of the question I'm raising.
You're channeling pretty well. I just, but that's a sign that you can articulate the other side, which is good, which is better than I can do.
Okay.
I'd have several things to say. The first is that I'm very sorry that the world is the way it is, but the world is the way it is. If you want to protect yourself, I'm not talking about you, getting involved in another cause. I'm not talking about you about how you have to act nice and be polite. I'm talking about you reaching your own ends. You cannot protect yourself at a time when Republicans are taking away the gains in all of your movements unless you play the game. I'm very sorry, life is like that. Life is like that. So face up to that. And so that's part of the message. The other part of the message is that part of the problem of seeing the world as, or the American population in terms of groups, is that you can't think of any kind of change of strategy except in terms of which other groups it's going to help. And the idea that there might be, to speak your language, a Pareto optimal move doesn't occur to you, right? And what I argue for in the book is to shift the focus from identity language to the language of principle and the principles that explain why we're for the things we're for, right? And it seems to me that the two basic principles that American liberalism has stood for since the 1930s, and they're things that Republicans explicitly reject, are social solidarity and equal protection under the law. Just about everything that every identity group is worried about right now in terms of actual policy out there can be explained in terms of equal protection under the law, most of them, right? And when it comes to the concerns, let's say, of the white working class that they no longer have any jobs, they don't have health insurance for their kids and all the rest, that's all about social solidarity. Now, the question of social solidarity doesn't just affect, obviously, the white working class. It affects the working class, working people of every background across the country, right? If we get people focused on the principles and say what we share are these principles, once you have people like that, then you can try to explain why it applies in your particular case. And so in that case, what you have to persuade the person of is, one, the principle, and two, that the principle applies. But what the identity people are trying to do is convince other people of their own account of American history and contemporary society today. They want you to accept your picture, right? And what that does is it sets the bar on agreement much higher than it needs to be, which is suicidal in politics. All you need is to convince people of enough that when they walk into a voting booth, they pull one lever rather than another. And you don't need to have them fall on their knees and have a revelation and go down to the River Jordan and get baptized, right? But a kind of evangelicalism has taken over these identity groups, where they're not interested in winning. They're not interested in power. They love being martyrs, and they don't mind screwing things up as long as they get to express themselves. Now, one thing that I wish I'd been clearer about in the book, and only became clear to me in defending the book and explaining it, is that I should have said more about the ways in which it's good that we talk about identity, that we can't talk about American history and make sense of American history without making sense of identity, and especially making sense of slavery and the legacy of slavery. You know, James Baldwin was right. White America can't understand even itself without understanding what it's done to African Americans. We also need to talk and be aware of identity to in order to build toleration in the country. That's all good, and we do that. And we need to pay attention to identity in order to understand certain social problems, that we can't talk about incarceration without talking about race, and so on, right? So in all those ways, identity consciousness is helpful. The problem is that when you go out to try to persuade people to vote and build a coalition or to get them attached to a program, you need to take that hat off and you need to put another hat off, and that's what they refuse to do.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. These are interesting ideas. Let's not raise the bar for agreement so high that it makes it impossible to create a governing coalition and so on. So Barack Obama, did you support him in 2008?
Oh man, did I? Sure.
Yeah. Was his ascendancy an exemplification of politics rather than the pseudo-politics that you decry in the book? Or was he in his personification of a kind of identity, our time has come, that's not his words, but that's kind of the message that went out to a lot of people, the hope and change mantra was that sent a thrill up Chris Matthews' leg or whatever it was largely tied to his unique qualities as a person of mixed racial ancestry, an African-American, in a way by choice, the nation's first black president, the historic achievement, so on and so on. You could even be excited about it. He also, Barack Obama, presided over this denouement that you were referring to of the Democratic electoral fortunes. I mean, it was during his time in office that at the federal level and at the state and local level, too, the Democratic Party fortunes went south. Many people claim that it was reactions against his identity, that is, a black person in the White House, that fueled some of the, you know, the birther stuff, the you lie being shouted out during a State of the Union address, and many other examples that could be given.
Sure.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, again, has put quite a fine point on this. He says we had nigger foreign policy. I'm quoting quotes from this article. We had nigger health care. We had nigger anti-terrorism. We had nigger economic revitalization legislation, by which he means every effort of the Obama administration was seen in certain quarters of American society as initiatives advanced by a N-I-G-G-E-R, that is to say, in the service of a black president whom they couldn't accept. So I guess I'm asking you to factor in to your analysis this recent political history of presidential politics of the triumph of Barack Obama breaking through in 2008, of the legacy that that breakthrough has left and the preservation of that legacy, because don't we have a anti-Obama in the White House now?
Sure.
And so on. So if I were someone inclined toward identity politics, I would feel that it was time to double down on my commitments to those ways of to that way of seeing the world in virtue of what has happened.
Oh, look, I agree actually with all the things you said. You know, what happened when he was shouted down in at the State of the Union never would have happened to a white president, of birthism and all of that. And it was complicated by the fact that it was the kind of melding of race with his class and his education and all the rest that, you know, made him such a target. You know, I'm not sure that a black sports star would have had quite the reaction that he did. And so there was a kind of that combination of being black, articulate, intelligent, and powerful was a real threat to a lot of white Americans. There's no doubt about that. And I can understand that because of that, you'd want to double down on your commitments. The question is, what do you do in order to gain power based on your commitments? So I have no problem with anything you said. The question is, what action does that lead to? And that's where Ta-Nehisi Coates gives you no answer, right? He's become such a fatalist that he does. It's not clear to me he thinks any action is going to help. You know, or I'd like to hear him talk about that. So yeah, but double down on your commitments, absolutely. But you know, there's got to come a point, especially when you're being beaten so badly, where you understand that the point is not to speak truth to power, the point is to become the power. You've got to have a thirst for power. You've got to want to wake up every day and ruin Steve Bannon's day. You've got to want to crush these people. And so if doubling down gets you to do that, I'm all for it. But if it instead encourages a kind of theatrical politics that leads to no electoral benefit and turns off a lot of people, that otherwise might be persuadable, then that's regrettable.
So at the Democratic National Convention last summer, that is the summer of 2016, amongst the things that the orchestrated political performance offered to the American public was a feature on mothers of the movement. And what they had were the mothers of Eric Garner and Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and others. I don't know all of who were included. These were African-American women whose children had been lost in altercations with police officers, and they had been killed on the stage. I'm still trying to ask the same kind of question, and that question is, what compromises should an identitarian be willing to accept on behalf of creating a greater chance of electoral success? On the other side of the, they were on the stage at the Democratic National Convention, Mothers of the Movement.
Yeah.
So we were affirming Black Lives Matter. We were affirming this part of the Democratic coalition's, you know, intense feeling about the equity issues with respect to policing in urban areas and police violence. And the mothers were offered as heroines. Now, a substantial number of Americans, I feel quite confident, were looking at that parade, and they were contrasting it with what was going on the other side, which was a guy who was saying that he was for law enforcement.
Yeah,
I'm with the cops. Blue lives matter too.
Yeah.
This kind of thing. I'm prepared to speculate that a great number of Americans' reflexive instinct was to side with the cops in a dispute between a Michael Brown and a Darren Wilson on a street in Ferguson, Missouri. Their instinct is to side with the cops. They see mothers of the movement on the stage at the Democratic National Convention, and their instinct is to say something like, well, if they had been better mothers, their kid wouldn't have been on the street at 2 o'clock in the morning, or wouldn't have been in a park playing with a toy gun, or wouldn't have been lifting cigarillos from a convenience store and getting into an altercation that led to the loss of their lives. What do you mean, mothers of the movement? Now, somebody's going to say that instinct is just so fundamentally wrong and so racist and so typically American white supremacist that it needs not to be compromised with. I'm not going to keep those mothers, those grieving mothers, off of the stage of the Democratic National Convention out of a calculation based on a focus group study that tells me that the median voter in Wisconsin or Michigan or Ohio is turned off by seeing black grieving mothers being honored for for their sacrifice and for their losses. I'm not going to side with the cops because I think that suburban Philadelphia or western Pennsylvania is likely to be moved my direction by siding with the cops just because I want to get, I don't know what, universal health care and I don't have enough votes in the Congress. I'm going to stick by my principles. And isn't your pragmatic and kind of political utilitarian argument asking me to abandon my principles? And doesn't that have long-term consequences, long-term normative consequences, by allowing the political culture to drift in a direction that is, you know, sort of contrary to the kind of equalitarian values that we should be affirming?
Yeah. Well, again, my focus is not on changing people's values. It's what they do in order to structure the world in such a way that their values can be defended and realized. And I would just have to say, I'm sorry, that's the choice you face. Politics is full of tragic choices. And every time, you know, you come to something like this, when the whole world's watching, and the whole world's watching everything now, because, you know, everything is, you know, filtered through the media, and you have to take that into account, everyone's going to be watching. So you have to decide, doing something like this might rally my base. And once they're rallied, then they'll go out and work harder to get elected. On the other hand, if I push this, some people are going to push back in the way you just suggested. So I have to figure out in each particular case what it makes sense to do. And everyone has to do this. Republicans have to do this, right? Because if you have let's say radical anti-abortion people, or you have radical people who believe that, you know, if you're a Christian and you hold a public office, and for instance, you're opposed to gay marriage, that you don't have to sign various papers and so on because it affects your conscience. Now, Republicans themselves know that some of these issues are just going to wear away at the middle of the road voter who someone says, well, I agree with Republican economic issues, but I believe in a woman's right to abortion, right? And so they've got a choice to make. That's just the nature of politics. I'm sorry. You've got those choices to make. And you just have to be aware and be, as long as you're willing to assume the responsibility for the electoral consequences of what you do, then do it. But don't pretend that's not the world you're living in. Now, it may be that this whole focus group stuff is bull, right? That it doesn't work that way. And I think a lot of that stuff has to be questioned. But again, one way out of this conundrum, I think, is, as I said earlier, is to not focus on cases, and especially not focus on groups so much, and not focus on cases, because cases are muddy. I mean, Ferguson is a muddy case, and you don't want to go to the mat over Ferguson. I'm sorry. But if you talk about principles that are animating your commitments and keep everyone focused on that, people could be persuadable and are persuadable based on the principles. Some people are going to reject those principles. Some people are going to accept them and not realize what that then commits them to, right? So a different kind of strategy that raises the conversation to another level allows us to avoid having to publicly deal with a lot of these, or to import this rhetoric and this approach into the electoral realm.
Okay, Secretary Clinton has come out with her campaign memoir, this new book, What Happened, Hillary Clinton. In it, as I understand it, I haven't read the book. It's been widely reported on in excerpts and so on. She is reported to have argued that one of the reasons that she lost, an important reason that she lost, had to do with her being a woman and with the powerful influence of sexist ideas in the American political culture. More is expected of a woman. Things aren't permitted of a woman. A woman has a tougher road to hoe. Do you believe that's true?
Oh, I sure. Yeah, I'm not sure. We could talk about particular cases, whether things have gotten better, and all the rest. But certainly, in the minds of a lot of people, all that is true.
The guy that won the Access Hollywood tape, the pussy grabber remark, the locker room talk, and so forth and so on. How is it that a thoughtful, reflective, progressive woman watching what happened in that campaign, I'm still trying to push back with you a little bit, I don't know if I'm getting the job done or not, could come away with anything but being reinforced in her determination to ensure that the prerogatives and, the aspirations of women as women are reflected in the political program of the Democratic Party? Are you asking them to back off from that?
No, not at all. But the question, that's motivation. Sure. I mean, getting upset about these things is motivation. That's great.
Same answer.
Now, once you're motivated, what do you
do? What are you going to do?
A political campaign, it's not a bulletin board where everyone gets to put up the little pictures they've drawn, right? It's not about self-expression. And so, yes, sometimes you have to shut up about what you actually believe in, the way that you have to shut up about things in a faculty meeting or shut up about things with your kids, right? that you have to be strategic sometimes. You can't always be, you know, bearing your soul and expecting everyone to genuflect before, you know, your vision of the world. You got to get stuff done, right? And also, even for the people the people you care about, they themselves are being affected by multiple issues, right? And so, you know, a young Black woman raising a kid alone in the South Side of Chicago has a lot of things to worry about. You know, she has the place of women in the world might be the least significant on her list. It might be economic issues. It might be policing issues. It might be racial discrimination issues, all sorts of things. So people get affected by all sorts of different things. And if you're always just thinking about the single issue that you're committed to, you're also not seeing how all these issues can interact.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that Barack Obama missed an opportunity to advance the kind of political thinking that's reflected in your book during his term in office as an African American who had risen to the highest political pinnacle to eschew the identity politics dimension of his own political rise once in office, to kind of push back against it as opposed to playing into it, which I think one could argue in his reaction, for example, to the Trayvon Martin and other incidents, in his, I don't know if I want to call it alliance or relationship with the likes of a person like Al Sharpton, in his Justice Department's and Education Department's exercise of its regulatory discretion in terms of enforcing any discrimination things and edicts and things of this kind. When he had the opportunity to, as an African American, say, race is not everything, it's not even the most important thing. I'm here to tell you that the most important thing is a set of universal principles about progressive whatever. When he had the opportunity to tell the rabble rousers and the movement devotees, I'm happy about all of your rabble rousing and your movement, but you know what? If we don't win some elections and if we don't get some laws on the books, we're not going to get anywhere. And oh, by the way, there are 320 million Americans, not just the ones who belong to these groups, and that's where we have to keep our eye on the ball. I'm asking, and maybe in asking, I betray the fact that I have entertained this hypothesis that an opportunity was missed, a kind of teaching moments were passed with civil disturbances in the streets of American cities where someone might have said, no, your movement like mass mobilization and remonstration is not really advancing our political ball here. In fact, it's going to be a problem. I actually want Claire McCaskill to get reelected to the Senate in Missouri, and, you know, you're making it a little bit more difficult for that to take place, and so on and so forth. I'm asking you whether or not you think the former president might have missed an opportunity.
You know, I have a hard time criticizing Barack Obama in anything. I mean, this man, you know, faced so many challenges, and I just thought, given the hand he was dealt, he was impeccable, right? It's hard to imagine anyone getting it better than he did. And sure, there might have been those teaching moments. He might have said, for example, your energy is great, but here's how you need to channel it right now, right? If this state goes Republican, it's going to be bad for African Americans throughout the state, right? And, you know, that could have worked. But, you know, and what I appreciated as well is he got halfway there, and maybe he couldn't have gone farther, in articulating this thing about principles. You know, he would use the word we a lot. Now, as you and I know, around the university, here on the left, whenever you say the word we, you have to do this. You have to put quote marks around it, you know, to show that you're skeptical that there's any such thing as we. And what did he say? He said, yes, we can. Or he said, that's not who we are, right? Now, what he didn't say is so much as what we can do or what we are that we're not when we do the other things. But it was a step in the right direction. But, you know, presidents are not that powerful. You know, we have a daddy complex about the presidency, and we think we just vote this person, everything's going to change. And if it doesn't, and they have to make compromises, we attack them. where the real change has to happen in the party, in the liberal culture, in the universities. And it means, you know, having to go out and get in touch with people around the country. And so it's, I really want people to focus much more on what's going on in the states where we're non-competitive and what to do about that. And also to focus on changing the discourse in the universities so that we end up educating young people who can go out and be politically effective.
Okay, I really do want to talk about the universities, but first let me ask you about how some conservatives, I mean, you're going to get criticized from the left and you're going to get criticized from the right. I think I saw a review somewhere, I don't know where, Commentary, National Review, whatever. But the sum and substance of it was Lilla blames identity politics for the failures of Democrats and liberals, but in fact, it's the policies that they promulgate that should be blamed for the failures of Democrats and liberals, to wit, these cities, which are basket cases, and all these pathologies that are besetting our urban civilization, all these difficulties and problems, have blossomed under the, under the observant eye and the responsible administrative, practice of, or irresponsible administrative practice of Democratic administrations. The welfare state has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, but as a matter of fact, the very issues that many conservatives pointed to going all the way back about the incentive problems, about the problems of dependency, about the importance of non-governmental and civil society and what civic society and whatnot are implicated. We've gone secular, we've gone postmodern. In our ethical sensibilities, there are no standards, there are no guardrails, and all of this has been celebrated. Liberation has been elevated over responsibility as a part of our sort of civic mantra.
I'm writing as a partisan liberal and trying to convince people to get away, to remove whatever barriers are on our side, to actually being more focused on institutional politics, right? But there is a connection between what I'm saying and what you just said, and that is that if you're focused on, there's always a danger in politics that you fall in love with your means rather than your ends, right? So you have an end and you think of a means to it, but then the means ends up taking precedence. And, you know, that happened with liberals and certain social programs in the 60s and 70s. And that happened with Republicans and tax cuts and cutting bureaucracy. They fell in love with the means. Right. But if your politics is based on an understanding of basic principles, right, then you can be more flexible in discussing and thinking about what means you need to employ in order to defend those principles and have them help people, right? And so, I hear that conservative criticism, not so much my book, but I hear what they're saying. And I don't mean that suddenly if we get our act together about this, everything is going to be smooth sailing. In one respect, though, I think things are going our way for a sad reason, and that is that people who've been voting Republican are suffering. Right? And they've got to know that tax cuts are not going to help the opioid crisis. It's not going to bring manufacturing jobs back. It's not going to give them health care. It's not going to do all sorts of things. And as you know, there are a lot of wiser Republican minds who've been talking for a long time, from Ross Douthat to the Reformicons to even when George W. Bush first ran a compassionate conservatism, their idea was, we ourselves have to respond to all these social problems. And they weren't able to. They became dogmatic. 9/11 happened, and we've been stuck on this. We were stuck on this on our side. And for a while, we got loose of it. During the Clinton years, there was a lot of social policy experimentation. There were ways in which they were trying to reform, welfare reform is sort of the biggest thing, and the rest. I actually think that when it comes to policy, things are going to start going our way because the Republicans, we may be proposing failed policies to face these problems, but we're facing them. And the Republicans are not even recognizing them.
I wish I could be as confident as you, or maybe I don't wish, that tax cuts won't quote, work, close quote, by which I mean won't lead to a higher economic growth rate and a greater economic activity. No, obviously they won't solve the opioid crisis or bring back coal miners' jobs, but you know, a booming stock market and a historically impressive rate of economic growth, were it to happen, seems to me that that might give the incumbent, this is Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress that I'm talking about, something to crow about. So I guess we're going to have to see about that.
Well, it will depend on whether the benefits of that trickle down to the people who voted for Trump. And I'm not confident of that.
Well, you know, what does history say about Ronald Reagan? You say that there were two dispensations, political dispensations in the 20th century, the FDR New Deal solidarity dispensation and the every tub on its own bottom, government is not the solution, it's the problem, let me keep my money, Reagan-esque dispensation. And it strikes me that, of course, amongst the left-of-center academics, the Reagan dispensation was awful. In the popular political imagination, the Reagan era, not only Republicans, I mean, President Obama even invoked Ronald Reagan's legacy at one point during his 2008 campaign, hasn't fared that badly. And I think if there hadn't been a boost of economic growth after the implementation of Reagan's tax cuts in the early 1980s, I know Paul Krugman might hear this and he's rolling his eyes back into the back of his head. But on the whole, Reagan was successful, wasn't he? As a political figure,
And there's a good reason why Obama referred to him, because and the most important thing that he learned is Americans crave hope. That you do not lead a country through moral indictment. That you lead a country by giving it a hope, especially this country, giving it a hopeful vision of what the country can be. And Obama respected Reagan's gift, his ability to do that. You know, you go back to, you think back, you know, back to the Carter years and how, you know, tone deaf Jimmy Carter, sensible man, but how tone deaf he was about these things, talking about malaise. And Reagan just said, "What malaise? I see no malaise. I see nothing wrong with the American people."
It's morning in America.
Morning in America. And now, of course, for Republicans, it's midnight in America. But, it's morning in America. And so, you know, it's if you're in this mindset of just indicting the country constantly, you are not in a position to develop a message that will give people hope and want them to join the bandwagon.
Yeah. Let me ask you one more thing. What would you say to someone who said, "I was around in the 90s. I saw Dick Morris at Bill Clinton's elbow fashioning triangulation strategies. They work at the ballot box. Yeah. He got reelected and he avoided impeachment, or at least he avoided being convicted under impeachment. And he left after 8 years with a presidency that he could look back on, notwithstanding some of the fiascos. With a certain degree of pride. And yet, he presided over the very welfare reform legislation that you mentioned earlier, which was a reconfiguration of the Social Security title that applied to indigent families that removed people's entitlement to assistance if they were indigent and so on. He presided over a ratcheting up of law enforcement at the federal level and money for its ratcheting up at the state level that was the early harbinger of mass incarceration, and so on. And he left his vice president, who was running in 2000 in a situation in an election that Al Gore ought to have won, vulnerable, and he was ultimately defeated by George W. Bush. Aren't you advocating something similar right now?
No, the idea of triangulation is that, you know, you say one thing on the stump, and then when it comes down, and then, you know, you give one group of people one message, you give another people another message, and you try to negotiate among these. What I'm talking about is being more abstract in the message in the way that Reagan was, where you articulate the principles and the vision, and then that gives you some wiggle room for talking about the various policies. And it's got to be said in Clinton's defense that certainly when it came to welfare reform, that, you know, had Democrats stayed in power and saw that one of the main problems with it is that people who, you know, were now obliged to work, didn't have daycare, they didn't have transportation, all those things, they would have fought for those things, right? And Republicans, you know, wouldn't provide those things. And then you also have to ask yourself, all right, what if there had been another 8 years of a more radical Reaganite in power? Where would we be? And yes, you get half a loaf. And yes, sometimes you do things and there are unintended consequences and they require revision. That's just recognizing that as just being a grown up.
Who do you see, Mark, in the front row of Democratic Party leaders today, who you think could be a standard bearer for the kind of vision about progressive politics that you advocate?
Well, I mean, I don't know them, and I'm not in a prediction business, certainly. Do I see a standard bearer? No. But, you know, it took us nearly four decades to get into this position. And it's going to take a long time to get out. I think the work that has to be done, apart from trying to win, you know, win elections in the short term, but I think it means building, you know, not only the party, but sort of liberal intellectuals and cadres and students who are educated in a different way and think differently about politics and change the culture within the liberal camp. And that's going to take time. You know, you have to create an environment where, you know, this kind of thinking is encouraged and rewarded and not demonized as my book is being demonized.
So you are at Columbia. I am at Brown. These are Ivy League institutions of some distinction. We're in the higher education business. Our students, many of them, go into politics and public service and help to shape the, you know, the activities of progressive, politically involved organizations and institutions. And yet, my guess is, you know, based on my experience, that this kind of argument, can we chill out on the identity politics a little bit and start trying to think about a broader vision of what our political principles are and have a pragmatic program about how we're going to actually gain the sufficient power to implement those principles in policy? Wouldn't go very far around here. It would attract a whole lot of pushback and a lot of vitriol. I think that would be the case here at Brown University. I expected it might well be the case at Columbia University. What are the prospects that the culture of American elite higher education, no small factor in this story, might evolve in a direction that would be more sympathetic to the kind of political sensibility that you're proffering in the Once and Future Liberal?
Yeah, you know, at the moment, the prospects are not terribly good. But, you know, things change, and all you can do is argue. All you can do is make the case. And you've got to appeal to, you know, people's desire to win and actually make things happen. And also, you know, somehow convey that this is kind of inspiring. It can be an inspiring vision of the country to think about the principles and getting back to moving forward to a new articulation of what it means to have solidarity in this country and a sense of public duty and a sense of care for fellow citizens and wanting to protect them equally, that can be an inspiring vision. You know, it's funny how quickly things can often change depending on events and people. You know, looking back for the book, I was looking back at the way in which American college students were characterized in the 1950s. And, you know, they were presented as being these apolitical kids who were just absorbed with themselves, and they're in their bobby socks and crew cuts, and they're going surfing on spring break. And in fact, a lot of them were reading, you know, the existentialists, and they were, you know, reading Thomas Merton, and they're joining Campus Crusades for Christ. And what happened? Jack Kennedy came along and said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And it fired them up, you know, it really fired them up. And they joined the Peace Corps, and, you know, they went down to the South and joined the marches and got beaten and fought for voters' rights and all that kind of stuff.
There weren't, Mark, in those years, any African-American studies departments.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, and it's a very good thing that we have them now, right? I think it's not a good thing that people major in these things because that, you know, can close your vision too much. But yeah, sure. Now we have these, but...
There weren't any third world. There weren't any third world cultural centers. There weren't any student of color orientation programs in August before the fall semester begins, right, for the first year class, etc.
Yeah, and somehow they got inspired and they went out, and that's because they were focused on this larger cause and these principles. You know, I don't have a problem. I think it's a good thing that some of these study centers, for example, are present. What I want is that people who aren't members of those groups take the classes, right? Is that I think every college student should take a course in African-American history. I think actually that should be a requirement. But if I have a young black student, I want to suggest that he studies Chinese history. You know, that the university should be a place where you get outside of your head. And the more we're able to present more of the world in the university, that's good. We have to teach it in a way that gets people out of themselves.
Amen, brother.
And the people said amen.
I definitely agree with that. We are not, our job, our pedagogic mission here ought not to be to reinforce our adolescent charges in their presuppositions when they come to us. It ought to be to shake them up and make them question everything they thought that they knew about themselves in the world before they got to the university, to make them think again. At least that's how I see it. Yeah, of course it's a good thing that there's African American studies. I mean, of course it's a good thing that there has been a movement to shift the way in which various specializations in the academic world think about, you know, our history, race relations, culture, yeah, literature, and so forth and so on, in a way that, you know, broadens the tableau that's in front of our students. I also agree that I would rather have a kid, you know, focus on economics or history or politics or literature or whatever in a discipline and have the ethnic studies aspect of that amplify the disciplinary focus rather than have it be the main thing. And I too agree that if we're going to have area and ethnic studies, it ought not to be a one-to-one fit with the identities of the people who are taking the classes, so that, you know, the subject matter stand on their own, but they don't necessarily represent an effort to cater to people who are in this or that group.
Yeah,
we're on the same page. But that's a subject for another discussion, I think.
All right. You gave me a run. You gave me a run for my money there. That was good.
I tried. I'm glad you enjoyed it, Mark. I thank you for your time. I wish you the best of luck with the book, and I hope your personal security is up to snuff.
Okay. All right. If I need a bouncer, I'll call you. All right?
Yeah, I've been working out, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.